I have the pleasure of introducing the next speaker, who's going to be talking about CFTR modulation and CFTR therapies. Dr. J.P. Clancy is professor of pediatrics at the University of Alabama in Birmingham and director of pediatric pulmonary at the same institution.
I'm going to focus in on one part of what Rick was discussing, and really it boils down to three things, and I hope that I keep it focused enough that when you walk out of here, these will be terms that make a little more sense to you. I wanted to give you a little disclosure information. The primary things, obviously, I've received some funding through the CFFT to be a translational center. I'm very active in current Vertex clinical studies. We have contracts to perform those studies and also to overread some of the biomarkers, such as the nasal potential difference. And I'm also serving a similar function with PTC in the development of their agent. And finally, some grant review activities. So I wanted to just review, we've spent a lot of time talking about new kind of molecules at this conference that do pretty interesting things, and I wanted to take a step back and remind us that there are many steps between a gene and its protein that it codes for. And the CF gene was found 20 years ago on chromosome number 7, and it codes for something called the CFTR, which stands for the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. And just remembering, the first step is that the DNA needs to be converted to a blueprint form called mRNA, which then goes out into a different part of the cell, the cytoplasma, and it is converted from mRNA into protein, and that process is called translation. And that happens in a part of the cell called the endoplasmic reticulum, or ER. And the protein then has to go through a number of processing and folding steps to before it is mature. And when it becomes mature, it is then transported up to the cell membrane where it does its job. And it basically works as a channel that transports chloride and also regulates a number of other ion transporters. So what's a modulator, and why is it different from other available CF therapies that are on used today in the clinic? Well, a modulator, rather than targeting symptoms, is really trying to target the underlying defects that cause CF, and in particular, really addressing the problems with CFTR. They're trying to restore function to proteins that don't work normally. It doesn't replace them. That would be gene therapy. It actually is trying to restore some level of activity that we hope is enough to overcome the symptoms. Again, we believe it's going to, we hope that it's going to address one of the primary causes, and therefore possibly could have effects before disease manifestations. Now, obviously, that's a few years away, but that certainly is the long-term goal. But as I mentioned before, there are many steps between the gene, the first level of protein production, and then the actual mature thing that goes and does what it's supposed to in the cell. And there can be defects in any one of those different areas. And because of that, there's very, very different targets. So drugs that are really addressing the early steps in creating CFTR really may not have a lot to do with a drug that's under development for the later steps in CFTR. So we're going to try to cover some of the agents that are being developed for these three general parts of normal gene and protein function. So how, if you had to make a drug that was going to fix CFTR or try to restore activity, how could you do that? Well, there's a number of ways you can go about it. And the first one would be that if you knew exactly what the protein looked like, you had what's called a crystal structure, so there was no question what you were looking at. In theory, you could build a drug that would fit and perhaps overcome the problem that's in that protein. Well, the problem with that right now is we don't have a full picture of CFTR. We're getting closer. In fact, we have parts of CFTR that have been crystallized, and we sort of have some long view pictures of the protein, but not quite enough to actually develop a drug based on the structure. So although that's a great principle, we're not quite there yet. Another approach to develop a drug or a modulator would be to really be at the bench, dissect the pathways that are involved in which cause the defect, identify targets in those pathways, and then in one example would be to adapt therapies that we know already work on one of those pathways and see if they work in CF. And some of that is what Rick was mentioning, is at least in general a way that people could approach restoration of function, and people are actually taking adapting medications that are in the clinic right now and finding out if they actually may have restorative effects on mutant CFTR. Or the third approach, which is most recent, would be to do what's called high-throughput screening. And you'll see abbreviation from time to time, HTS. And this really takes the bulk, or I guess I would say brawn over brains approach. And the idea basically is to screen a whole bunch of compounds, find things that do what you hope that they'll do, and they describe those as having hits. They validate those, confirm that they actually have the activity that they think, and then try to take that identified molecule and turn it into a medication or a drug that hopefully eventually becomes a medication. And this general approach has been used by, at least three of the compounds that are currently in clinical studies. And the general principle is that cell lines that express the mutant CFTR or perhaps a reporter gene that has sort of similar characteristics may allow us to test drugs to see if they can overcome the defect that is specific to that problem, such as Delta F508 or G551D or a gene that has a premature stop mutation. And this has been approached by PTC Therapeutics, and they brought the current agent, former name, PTC-124, into clinical studies, now is called Adaloran. And then Vertex Pharmaceuticals, which has two agents currently in clinical trials. One is the potentiator VX770, and the second is VX809, of which corrects is geared towards correcting Delta F508. So I wanted to give you a little background about how each of these agents work and then provide a little bit of background of some of the clinical research that supports their activity in human subjects with disease-causing mutations. So suppressors of stop mutations would approach what are called a class 1 mutation, and that is one of the very early steps in taking a gene to a protein. And one example of this is called a premature termination codon, or PTC. It just happens to be the company name, but they actually don't mean the same thing. And if you look through the genetic info, as you're reading about these genes, as you get them back from newborn screens or diagnostic things, you'll see an X, the characteristics X, and that's basically the shorthand for stop mutation or premature termination codon. And in that process, if we look at my very bad little picture here, what we're looking at is an example of mRNA, that's that kind of squiggly thing, and that has the genetic information that had been taken from the gene. And on it is that blue thing that is called a ribosome, and what that does is basically translates the information on the RNA to a protein. And so at the beginning of the picture, we have a stop sign right here, and this is a premature stop mutation. Basically, that is an error in the genetic information that codes, instead of coding for an amino acid and making a protein, one of the building blocks, it codes for a stop sign. And what happens is as the ribosome is chugging along, it hits the stop sign and basically releases, and what you're left with is what's called a truncated protein or a very short piece of protein. And it turns out that in addition to that, oftentimes this process lowers the amount of available protein in RNA. Now, if you have an agent that happens to target that process, that would be an agent that could be suppressing a stop mutation. What it does is it allows the ribosome to sort of read past that error in the message. Maybe not every single time, but quite a bit, so that your ribosome is then able to go past that stop sign and in theory hit the authentic stop codon that's at the end of the gene, and therefore what you'll end up with is actually a full-length protein. And again, the level is not as much as you would find in the absence of that stop mutation, but we hope enough to actually restore enough activity to be clinically meaningful. And the idea of suppressing premature termination codons, or PTCs, is not a new idea. Actually, it was first described in bacteria about 45 to 50 years ago. I think the earliest reference I saw was 1964. It was first shown in bacteria and yeast, and it turns out aminoglycosides, a very commonly used class of antibiotics, some of those members will actually have this effect. And if we think about how aminoglycosides work, maybe it isn't too surprising. Turns out that aminoglycosides bind to ribosomes, and they can have effects on the ability of that ribosome to accurately read from the RNA. And this principle, though, was first applied, though, to try to treat genetic diseases in the mid-1990s. And the studies have been built on quite a number of preclinical research projects, including single cells, transgenic mice, and subsequently in CF patients. And this is a figure that I'm just showing you from a study that was reported by Mike Wilshensky from Israel, and his experience with using a nasal dropper type of study in which the medicine gentamicin, commonly used to treat a variety of infections, was dripped into the nose of patients who either had the Delta F508 mutation, two copies, or had a PTC. And what we're looking at is their CFTR activity, which is being measured by a test called the nasal potential difference. So at baseline, before the study, this is their value, and it's basically in the CF range. If you have two copies of Delta F508 and you're treated with placebo, basically just a saline solution, nothing really happens. And then if you give them 2 weeks of gentamicin as a dropper, again, nothing much happens. However, if you are one of these patients that carries one of these premature stop mutations, again, the baseline is here, placebo here, and when they are treated with gentamicin for 2 weeks, there was improvement in their CFTR activity by the nasal PD. So that was really probably the most convincing first early evidence that this principle could be applied to human subjects. The agent which has progressed to phase 3 clinical studies is called PTC-124, and it, again, was developed through HIPWIT screening, and it is not an antibiotic, it is not an aminoglycoside, but it does have some of the features in the sense of an aminoglycoside in that it does interact with the ribosome, and it can cause that ribosome to read past stop mutations on occasion. There have been human studies that have been performed in Israel, in the U.S., in Belgium, and France, including involving CF patients, and it's also been studied in patients with muscular dystrophy. Turns out that the whole principle of stop mutations is not unique to CF. It actually is found in most genetic diseases, in fact, if not all to some event. And the picture to the right is just my cartoon picture of a cell, and it's just reminding us that this is one of the early steps in taking a gene down here to a protein up there, and it's really addressing the early steps in this process. So I wanted to just show you one slide summarizing research that was completed published within the last year by Eitan Karim and colleagues in Israel, in which they investigated PTC-124 in patients who had premature stop mutations. And in this study, the patients were treated with either a low dose or a higher dose of the agent, and they had measurements of their CFTR activity by the nasal PD measured at before they were treated and after they were treated. And each one of these little measured dots is a different patient, and what we're measuring here is their CFTR activity, and what we're hoping to see is changes in the downward direction, which would reflect more activity of CFTR. And what we could see is at the beginning of the study, compared to at the end of a 2-week treatment period, there was in general a reduction in their nasal PD value, indicating activity of CFTR that was restored. There was a washout period, and then patients were treated with a second dose. And again, in general, there was a reduction in the nasal PD, so it was statistically significant. So several of these patients who were treated actually took their NPDs from the CF range into the lower side of the normal range, and in fact, some of these patients well into the normal range. So certainly very exciting and provocative findings, which have now led to a phase 3 study that is currently enrolling patients. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about an agent which has been mentioned too in the last 2 to 3 days, and these agents that I want to discuss are called potentiators. And these are basically small molecules that are geared to open CFTR. And they would be the most logical target for this type of agent would be a CFTR that actually gets to the cell membrane, because you need to have CFTR available to actually be able, obviously, to open it. And the one that is most common that fits that bill is called G551D. And that mutation causes, there is a normal amount of mutant CFTR at the cell membrane, but it's not able to be activated by the normal pathways. It is found in about 3-4% of patients. And what the goal of a potentiator is to essentially unlock that channel, help it get to a configuration which allows chloride to go through and for it to be normally regulated. And so this is a slide that was a compliment of Fred Van Goor from Vertex, which is just showing that on really the very microscopic level. And I want to show you again I'll tell you on the right side what a potentiator is doing is working at the very end of this process. It's really trying to help a CFTR that doesn't work correctly that's already at the cell membrane. And what we're looking at on the left side here are basically these are single channels of CFTR. And what we're looking at is the fraction of the time that they're open. And if we start here with the white one, that's actually a wild-type CFTR, a normal CFTR. And it turns out that if you measure the amount of time CFTR spends open, it actually is roughly 40 to 50%. And if you look at a G551D CFTR, it spends a lot less of its time, in the range of less than 10%. When VX770 is added, though, to the G551D, it actually helps restore its activity to actually essentially to wild-type levels. So this kind of type of preclinical work was what supported the principle that a potentiator may be, have effects on CFTR in vivo in human subjects. So this is a complicated slide that has been shown before. I won't spend great detail on it or a great amount of time, but this is just summarizes the study design for the recently completed phase 2 study of VX770. And it was a two-part study. The first part evaluated four doses and placebo in a kind of a crossover format. And each patient was treated for two-week blocks followed by washout, then two more weeks. And the part two, we basically took two doses and compared that with placebo, and that was for a full one-month treatment period. This study was completed in all adults. As one would expect, everybody had the G551D mutation, and 80% happened to be G551D and delta F508. And by and large, their lung function was in the mild to moderate range. And this is some of the original data that was presented by Frank Accurso at last year's meeting. And I actually like looking at this because it shows it twice. And to me, that I don't know, that sort of helps me confirm the effects that we think we're seeing here. And what we're looking at here is the effect of treatment with VX770 on sweat chloride values of CF patients. And what we're looking at is this is the first part of the study from measuring it day baseline before drug, 7 days, and 14 days. And looking at the sweat chloride values, the 100 value being here, the cutoff for CF diagnosis 60 being right here. And what you can see is that the placebo have no change, lower dose, medium, and higher dose, progressive reductions in sweat chloride over the course of treatment. The second part of the study confirmed these findings and showed it over a one-month period, took it to a little higher dose, basically showing, again, very stable, no change in the placebo group, reductions in sweat chloride values. This is actually the high dose and the 150 milligram dose down below. Again, very close, if not below, the cutoff for a CF diagnosis for a number of the patients. The exciting thing about this study, I think, was the fact that it had effects across different types of markers, such as the sweat chloride and another test that I alluded to before, the nasal potential difference. And this basically measures CFTR activity in your nose. And we think that that's actually a representation, or at least is connected to the levels of CFTR that are going on in the lungs. And what we're looking at here, again, is the CFTR activity as measured by the nasal PD at baseline in the different doses. Placebo and the low dose really didn't have measurable effects, while the medium and higher doses began to have improvements, taking the NPD again towards the out of the range of beginning to take it out of the range of the CF diagnosis. The second part, again, placebo, really no changes over the courses of measurements. This is the 150 and the 250 milligram dose, and really seeing that a number of the patients had improvements that were really quite unusual to see in patients with CF. One of the most exciting things, I think, is the fact that in addition to these measures of CFTR activity that we can do by sweat glands or by the nasal PD, there is complementary improvements in lung function. Again, the part one data, placebo, little effect, and then dose-dependent improvements in lung function here shown as improvements over baseline FEV1, approximating 10%. And in part two, again showing rapid improvements in the higher dose of the study that was significant over relative to baseline values. So we've talked about two of the types of agents that are under development, and I want to take us into the third, which is currently in phase two clinical trials. And that is the delta F508, or agents which are geared to help address the problems caused by delta F508. So as we are probably all well aware, delta F508 is the most common cause of CF in CF. It's found in, you can find at least one copy in about 80 to 90% of CF patients and 65 to 70% of all CF chromosomes. And the problem is folding. In other words, after the protein is converted from RNA into protein, it gets stuck. It's not able to progress like it's supposed to through the cell and up to the cell membrane where it can perform its function. And we can see this in a variety of ways. This is a photomicrograph that was taken from colleagues at Chapel Hill showing where the normal CFTR resides on the top of airway cells here in green. And in the delta F508 expressing cells, we see that this green protein is unable to get to the cell membrane where it's supposed to do its job. So if we look more closely, what is the problem? How can one little amino acid problem or deletion cause such a dramatic effect on this protein? And what you're looking at here is a model of what we think the part of CFTR that possesses Delta F508 looks like. And what we're looking at is basically normal and Delta F508 sort of superimposed on each other. And we're starting up here. There's basically a blue and a red. And the point is they are very similar. When you look at this area is called the nucleotide binding domain, or NBD1. These two look very similar through many of the ways that you look at, except in a couple of places, and this is where Delta F508 is. It turns out it's sort of on the outside of this structure, and it makes some of the loops of protein sort of stick out. There's one right here, and there's one out here that seem to really deviate away from the normal. And it's not known 100% for sure what this really, how this causes, but the working hypothesis is that when those things are sticking out, it causes destabilization, and in particular, how that little domain interacts with other parts of this very complicated protein. And so what happens is we think that CFTR is not able to sort of compact into its normal configuration. And that it's very important that the early parts of the protein are actually able to interact in a way to compact the later parts of the protein. So when those compacting steps don't happen, it turns out that the protein is very susceptible to being broken down. And so again, the part of the cell where it's broken down is called the proteasome, but the point of it is it doesn't look terribly different at a molecular level, but there are subtle differences that have dramatic effects on how well the cell can use the protein. Well, it turns out Delta F508 may be a little more complicated than just that. So there is certainly clear evidence that the protein doesn't fold correctly, so very little of it, if any, gets to the plasma membrane where it's supposed to do its job. In addition, a lot of the preclinical work suggests that even when it gets to the cell membrane, if you can get it there by some maneuvers, it doesn't work very well. The chloride channel stays closed more than it stays open. Now, there's some more recent work that suggests that hopefully that maybe not be as big a barrier as we thought, but clearly preclinical work so far has brought up that concern that the protein at the cell membrane doesn't work very well. And finally, we also know that once it gets there, it doesn't stay there very long. In fact, the cell, for some reason, sees it as abnormal, tries to take it back inside, and that process is called recycling. So we really have a lot of things to address with Delta F508. So correctors, an example being that being developed by Vertex, VX809, the goal of these are to increase the surface density and function of Delta F508, the cell membrane. In other words, help in general, it's trying to correct the folding problems that are causing the vast majority of problems with the protein. A potentiator, as we had mentioned, is trying to increase the activity. So you could certainly see that perhaps these two might have something to do with each other. If you can correct the folding and bring some of that Delta F508 to the cell membrane, perhaps it'll be a target for an agent like VX770, which could actually help it to work the best it possibly could. And this has been demonstrated in vitro or in preclinical research studies. Again, this was performed by Vertex Pharmaceuticals. And I know this is a kind of complicated slide, but what we're looking at is concentrations of drug on the x-axis and basically activity or how much chloride is being transported on the y-axis. And the bottom is showing increasing doses of VX809 for Delta F508 expressing cells. And what we see is that indeed there is a significant improvement in chloride transport in the presence of 809 alone. Interestingly, if you add 770 on top of that, you shift everything up. You actually can essentially double the amount of activity of the Delta F508 that is produced by 809 alone. So certainly suggesting that the two agents may be very nicely complementary. So I wanted to summarize quickly. There are just a handful of points that I think which will be really helpful as we go forward with these agents and as they go through phase 3 trials and start discussing them with our patients. CFTR modulators are trying to address the underlying cause of CF by helping to restore activity to the proteins that are dysfunctional and cause the symptoms. Suppressors of stop mutations target stop mutations, those little X's that you see on your genotype information. Potentiators, they're trying to open the chloride channel. And finally, correctors are trying to really target that primary folding defect in Delta F508, and we hope also have effects on how it functions at the cell membrane. And what I think that this going to take us to is that we're going to be able, at least I think our vision is that we'll be matching the genotype of patients to certain types of treatment strategies. And I think obviously that's a cause for a lot of excitement within the field. And the pictures you're seeing, that's where I work, Children's Hospital of Alabama, and that is Vulcan. He's the largest iron statue in the world, whatever that is worth. And he overlooks my city. Wait, so I want to thank you all for the opportunity to give you an update on the current modulator studies. I was told by Peter I have a moment. If there are any questions, I'm happy to try to answer them. Let's say that some of these agents, such as a corrector for Delta-F508, becomes approved for treatment of CF caused by Delta-F508. Will we be able to use those drugs in other CF-causing mutations? Is that essentially yes? It's a fair question, and I think the answer is yes and no. It turns out, and again, I actually saw this information today. It's been a great conference, and I've actually learned quite a bit, and one of these things I was really questioning about was that exact question. My understanding, without being the person who's done this research, is that VX-809 can improve some folding of some mutations that are caused by other folding defects, but it's not universal. It doesn't have effects on wild-type CFTR. I don't believe it has effects on G551D CFTR. It doesn't increase the amount at the cell membrane. So I think it's going to be really very genotype-specific, and it's going to be a bit tedious probably to work that information out, which are the patients most likely to benefit beyond those studied who have two copies or arguably one copy of Delta-F508. But I think that is one of those questions that we are really going to be wrestling and trying to answer over the coming years. Okay, thanks again.